What are the public misconceptions about environmental, social, and governance issues? And how can ESG leaders craft an integrated strategy to create value for multiple stakeholders? Catherine Niebe is the Duke Energy Corporation's Chief Sustainability and Philanthropy Officer. She joins Darden Professor Allison Elias for a conversation about the state of leadership and strategy in ESG in this episode of Leadership Unscripted.
Good afternoon. Great to see everyone. Thank you to Catherine for being here. We are fortunate to have such an esteemed guest. I want to introduce Catherine for those who might not know her bio. She's really a sustainability expert and has a lot of knowledge across industries and sectors. She's currently Senior Vice President of National Engagement and Strategy, as well as Chief Sustainability and Philanthropy Officer at Duke Energy. She leads Duke Energy's stakeholder engagement efforts to develop solutions to meet customer needs for continued reliable and affordable energy, while also simultaneously working to achieve the company's goal of net zero carbon emissions by 2050. In addition, Catherine maintains oversight of the Duke Energy Foundation, which provides philanthropic support to help meet the needs of communities where Duke Energy customers live and work. Catherine started at Duke Energy in August 2020, coming from Walmart, where she led ESG strategy and oversaw stakeholder engagement on behalf of Walmart's sustainability team. Before Walmart, from 2007 to 2013, Catherine was at the World Wildlife Fund, where she managed one of the world's largest corporate NGO partnerships, a $97 million sustainability-driven initiative with the Coca-Cola Company focused on water, agriculture, and climate, which was active in over 45 countries. And actually, Catherine and I worked together on a case with some other faculty, which has been a really popular case and reprinted in several case books about that partnership. Catherine's a First Movers Fellow through the Aspen Institute, and she received her MBA from the Darden School in 2004, right?
Yep.
And then you also have a Bachelor of Arts in English.
I do.
Great to have you.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I just want to start with just some basics. I mean, how do you define ESG, and how has that changed over the years of your career? And then we'll talk a little bit about ESG and then move towards the end of the conversation to Catherine's career journey.
Great. Well, and I should also mention, you and I have been friends for a very long time.
We have, before.
So it's super fun to have a chance to connect as professionals as well.
Yes,
which is really
two professionals.
Exciting. That's right, we're professionals, everyone. Yeah. But at any rate, so ESG, I like to think of as fundamentally it's strategy. It's a strategic question for enterprises. And I think everyone knows the acronym ESG, but it means environmental, social, and governance. And when I'm at a company or working with a company, it's really kind of fundamentally asking, what are the environmental and social factors out there that are risky for the business and for the stakeholders served? And then also, where can the company add value and create kind of positive difference, competitive advantage on dimensions of environment or societal issues? I tend to leave out the G because I think that's so foundational to a company's performance. So that's got to be a core part of their DNA. When I got started in this field a little bit over 25 years ago, give or take, there was a lot of kind of skepticism about this idea. What does it really mean? It must mean nonprofit work. It must mean kind of volunteerism. And I've always believed that it's really core to how a company functions. That being said, the trend line that I've at least seen in my career has been one where you had this era of what I would call kind of, I mean, you had compliance and then you had beyond compliance, but this field really started to mature as you introduced corporate social responsibility, which I tend to think of as a nice to do. And then it moved into this sustainability world, which was kind of a should do, a little bit like doing your homework. You really probably should be thinking about what sustainability issues are relevant. And now that we're in this ESG world, it to me is really much a business imperative, a must do. And so that's been a really fun evolution to watch, and then to see other people, my Darden classmates from the class of 2004 who were like, oh, bless your heart, when I kind of ventured off into this field, and now kind of picking up the phone and calling me and saying, I need to get up to speed on this. Can you please provide me some insights so I can bring that back to my company?
I'm so eager to hear about your career path, because you really were a first mover, as the Aspen Institute title says, in the space. And I imagine that was a difficult path to blaze. And we'll talk about that a little more. So what I'm hearing you say is that maybe what the priorities are, whoever's doing ESG work in a company, the priorities are to be very different, or yep, somewhat different, depending on your industry or the firm.
Yes.
The needs of the different stakeholders.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, what about at Duke Energy and just utility sector in general? Quite a shift from, yeah, other ESG you've done, worked in different industries. But
yeah,
what kinds of things are top of mind there?
Yeah, well, coming over to Duke Energy, it was kind of a real pleasant surprise, because we like to say that our business strategy goes hand in hand with our climate strategy, which is kind of a new experience for me. I'm used to working in sustainability to try and embed these issues in the kind of core of what a company is doing. And then I arrived at a company and they were like, we're already there. We're already doing it. And let me just give you a few examples of when we say our business strategy is our climate strategy, how that really manifests. I think a great example is just if you look at our capital plan. So over the next decade, we're anticipating spending about $145 billion as we lead one of the largest clean energy transformations in the nation. 85% of that is earmarked towards kind of quote unquote green investments. So really looking at the totality of our business moving forward in that direction. Last year, we expanded our net zero by 2050 work, which had originally centered on our direct footprint or our scope one emissions, to include scope two and scope three emissions. And so now 95% of our total greenhouse gas footprint is encompassed in a net zero goal by 2050. So all of the different levers, both our direct footprint and then beyond, we're really looking at how do we drive emissions out of the system. And then part of our transition is really going to involve the retirement of coal. The energy industry is going through massive transformation right now, and we're leading the largest planned retirement of coal in our industry, with plans to retire 16 gigawatts of coal. We've already been had the opportunity to see what good looks like. We've already retired 56 units and roughly 7,500 megawatts of coal. And I bring this up because so often the ESG conversation really centers on the E of environment, but the S is so important to get right. As a regulated utility, we have a responsibility to ensure that our power is reliable and affordable and accessible to the communities that we serve. But we're also thinking really deeply about, as we retire those coal assets, what are the impacts to the employees and the surrounding community? As we build that $145 billion capital plan, what are the impacts to the communities as we move forward? So what are the environmental justice considerations, the climate justice considerations that we need to be thinking about? And as we envision this new energy system, or this rebuilt energy system that is increasingly clean, how are we thinking about issues like energy insecurity, energy burden, and energy equity? So it's a real opportunity, I think, to focus in on the E, but also understand how it relates directly to the S. And I think one of the things that is exciting to me is, as we think about the impact of the S, there's a real upside to that. So I talked about our $145 billion capital plan. We hired EY to take a look at what are the economic outputs that come as the result of our clean energy transition in the next decade, and it's around $250 billion of economic output. So additional jobs that are being created, property taxes that we're paying that are going to go to fund things like schools and first responders. So it's an exciting time.
Really exciting time. So many goals. And I'm really curious how you educate employees about, how these goals fit into you know, other parts of the corporate strategy. I know that there's been a recent survey at Duke that shows that the more educated employees are about the corporate strategy and the ESG strategy, the more they feel engaged in the company. Yeah. And I'm sure that that's a large part of, you know, trying to educate not just all the way executives to frontline workers, so people understand how this is affecting their jobs and what their purpose and mission is.
Yeah, absolutely. I think when I was younger, I kind of would roll my eyes whenever anyone introduced like corporate purpose, corporate mission. But as I've gotten older and deeper into my career, I think I've really come to appreciate how important that corporate purpose, that corporate mission is in really galvanizing an entire organization behind that objective. And we've absolutely seen, as we've educated our employees and shared with them about what we're trying to achieve in terms of the clean energy transformation, but also how their function plays such a strategic role in our delivery of that, they become much more excited about the work, much more empowered about the work, and much more engaged.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. How do you all measure ESG progress? Or, I mean, there's so many sort of metrics, and I know what are the things you try to emphasize or, you know, roll out to the public?
Yeah, it's like the $10,000 question right now, where everyone is trying to figure out how do you actually measure this stuff. And I wish I had a satisfactory answer. I think for any corporate practitioner, we are in an era of declining trust. And so transparency is absolutely fundamental. It's foundational to establishing any kind of trust. Duke Energy, as a regulated utility, has been reporting a variety of our emissions to the EPA for decades. So we're comfortable and familiar with what it means to disclose information. We've been reporting on our sustainability progress for, I think this year is our 17th year of our sustainability or ESG report. We also do a climate report, which is aligned with the Task Force on Climate-Related Financial Disclosures. We just this year released a supply chain diversity report. And then we have, for the last 2 or 3 years, released a trade association climate review. And so those are vehicles that you can use as a company to articulate your story the way you want to articulate, really building on this drumbeat of how is this strategic, how is this mitigating risk, how is this creating value. But there are, of course, about a billion, I don't think I'm exaggerating, kind of third-party frameworks for ESG reporting and disclosure. And so we've been prioritizing SASB, GRI, EEI, AGA, CDP, and probably some others out there that I'm forgetting. So I think we're really interested in telling our story, both the way we think the strategic angle kind of focuses, and then also how third parties are looking at this information. But I will say, this notion that there's going to be one standard or one framework, I mean, I wish it was true. I wish there were 20 disclosures or even 100 disclosures that we could all agree, okay, now I've got insight into your ESG strategy. I don't believe that that's in the near term in any meaningful way.
I mean, I suppose over the course of your career, you've seen just an increase in the number of third-party frameworks. And on the one hand, great, right?
Right.
Where people are interested in trying to talk about how to measure this and have their own systems.
But,
difficult sometimes for other stakeholders to make sense of.
I spend a lot of time kind of thinking, when it comes to disclosures and metrics, about not that I think we all need to be creating our own disclosures, but I do spend a lot of time thinking about what are meaningful disclosures. And so thinking about inputs, outputs, and impact metrics, and doing a little bit of teasing out what are you truly measuring, and then what is it telling you? Mm-hmm. I think often in the ESG and sustainability space, people are interested in impact, but what they can get their arms around is input. Maybe if they're lucky, an output. So I'll give you an example. Input might be the number of renewables that Duke Energy is putting on the system in the next 5 years or 10 years, or perhaps a capital plan spend. That might be a meaningful number. An output would be, are we seeing declining greenhouse gas emissions as a result of those investments? That I can kind of see a very clear line for how you would get there. And then the impact would be, well, does all of this work lead to outcomes that are consistent with the ambitions of the Paris Accord?
Right, and in align with the goals of the company.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, we know that ESG is a growing presence across different types of companies, both public and private. As of the end of 2020, 88% of publicly traded companies had ESG initiatives in place. 79% of venture and private equity-backed companies had something in place, and 67% of privately owned companies. So we're seeing definitely increased focus in the business world, yet we have a really, particularly at this moment, polarized political and economic climate, social climate about a lot of issues. What sorts of public misperceptions do you think exist? And there's criticism both on the left and the right of, you know, what's going on in companies today with ESG.
Yeah, we're certainly in a very interesting moment in time, and one that I think has been building for at least as long as I've been working in or at corporate America. And I think in a polarized society, companies really finding a middle ground is so critical, and we to some degree don't have the luxury to sit on the sidelines. That being said, whenever I'm challenged or whenever I'm talking to peers about how they're navigating these uncharted waters, always going back to the business fundamentals. What is advancing the business? What is mitigating risk? And where are your stakeholders when it comes to the issues? And I find that that ecosystem really enables a company to make much more sound decisions about moving forward.
Yeah, do you feel like this is a moment that we're going to pass through, or do you feel like, you know, this is just the focus of a lot of tensions and polarization? And
I certainly hope we find ourselves on the other side of reasonable people can agree, reasonable people can disagree, and this surfacing of the dialogue is actually a really important part of navigating kind of what are the stakeholder dynamics that are at play. For Duke, I go back to our core business, which is, is everything that I'm doing in service of our corporate mission to provide reliable, affordable, increasingly clean and accessible energy to our customers? And if I can draw a line showing how I'm delivering on that corporate strategy, I feel much more confident that I'm making the right decisions and providing the right counsel for the company.
Right. Well, I'd love to move to talking about your career a little bit, because I know a lot of students at Darden, and as well as people professionally who are in other functions, are really interested in how do I get into this space, you know, and it isn't necessarily a traditional path. It's sort of an emerging profession or sort of association of different professionals. So, I mean, when did you first become interested in this type of work? Was it in college? Was it not until, you know, business school?
Yeah. Well, you've had the luxury of knowing me for a long time and both the highs and the lows of my career journey, as it sometimes made sense.
I'm not sure the lows, actually.
Other times have been a little more confusing.
Maybe in your head.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so I've always been interested in this intersection between environmental and social issues and business performance. I don't think I could articulate that when I was 21 or 22.
Sure.
It kind of grew over time. But it's always been this core kind of value or personal identity of really wanting to do something meaningful to advance environmental or social issues in the right way. So that's been kind of core. But I would say there have been a couple of low points. So I graduated from Darden and was unemployed. And I moved back home into my childhood bedroom. And my parents said, "What happened?
We sent you to business school.
We've read the brochures. They assured us that you would be employable after this experience." And I said, "Well, there's always one, right?" So, so there have been some real professional highs and then some lows. And I think the advice I would give anyone who is pursuing a path that may not look kind of core or mainstream, particularly in a business school environment, is that it's okay. It's okay not to know what you're doing with a degree of certainty. It's okay to try things. It's okay to take a job and realize that was a mistake. Like, this is how you learn, this is how you grow. And I do think sometimes breaking apart from the crowd does allow you to really create a niche for yourself in a compelling way. I think the other thing I've observed in this sector is people feel that it's very binary. I'm either working in sustainability, advancing an environmental or social or governance principle that I'm personally passionate about, or I'm selling out have been used. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it's so binary. When I think about my role as a sustainability practitioner, it's really sitting down across the table from the supply chain team or from the marketing team or whomever, and articulating what issues need to be top of mind and why, and having dialogue and conversation. The person who's actually really going to be implementing a lot of the work is, in fact, the business partner. And mm-hmm. so I encourage people, no matter what career they step into, to really explore how is sustainability relevant to the decisions that I need to make? What are the risks? And then what are the opportunities? And how can I think about my business in a more holistic way? Often people think about how do I make this pencil out financially? And you do have to make things pencil out financially. But you can also think about issues like supply chain security, supply chain continuity, customer trust. Like there are a host of different ways that you can get into this space in a way that is meaningful and credible.
Yeah, just to stick with Darden for a minute, I imagine you were, how many people, was there a handful of people interested in doing environmental work?
I think you're looking at her.
Okay. So yeah, so that's tough, right?
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
really tough to blaze your own trail. And especially when there's a lot of worn paths that
yep.
that is, you kind of can follow a herd.
Yep.
Yeah, so I mean, obviously turned out great for you. What would you recommend people or you know students who are at Darden, what could they be doing to try to learn more
yeah.
about the field and find job opportunities? We yeah. know jobs are growing in this area. There's definitely demand.
They absolutely are. I think three of the things about Darden that I think are really going to be helpful as someone enters this field or generally speaking in their career,
yeah.
it's the case study method. It's the solid focus on ethics, and then it's stakeholder theory and stakeholder engagement. I think those are three fundamentally powerful tools. Sustainability, as much as people want to study it and learn about it, for the practitioner, the case study I find is the most realistic way of understanding how you need to be thinking about mm-hmm. sustainability. Because these are not decisions that live in a vacuum. These are not decisions where
there's not one answer.
I'm off on an mm-hmm. island doing my own thing mm-hmm. and everyone's like, just do what you really have to figure out what are the business challenges, what are the opportunities, and then how do I work together with my business partners, perhaps with NGOs, with academics, mm-hmm. to arrive at a really solid and sound decision that you can defend. I think about ethics. I mean, mm-hmm. we're there's a reason for declining trust. And mm-hmm. so I think having a sound, principled view of what is fundamentally right, what is wrong, what is good for the business, what is good for the community, for our customers, is fundamental and foundational. And it seems easy, but issues do pop up where you really have to think about what is the right thing to do. Here at this moment in time. So I think being conversant in ethics is really critical. And then stakeholder theory, like I think about politicians. They need to amass 51% of the registered voters to support their agenda and their platform. I can't say about whether or not that is easy or hard. I have zero interest in being a politician. But businesses don't have that luxury. They have to appeal to their customers. Customers vote, we used to say in my last life, that customers vote with their feet every single day. So understanding where your all of your stakeholders are, and that includes your customers, it includes the communities you operate in, it includes your supply chain, it includes your investors, it includes the policymakers. So I think really being able to almost sit in someone else's shoes for a day and understand what they may be thinking and experiencing related to your company is just foundational as well.
What you're saying makes me think that Darden students should see themselves as having an advantage in a lot of ways because of the way ethics is embedded, you know, into the Darden curriculum and, you know, the prominence and of Ed Freeman and, and we're big fans.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's a huge advantage that you're at Darden and you have a core curriculum that has really embedded these things. So you've worked, you know, nonprofit, you know, retail, now utilities. What parts of doing sustainability work transfer across industries or sectors?
Yeah.
And then I imagine there's just a lot to learn when you get into a new position. I'm always amazed to see when I read about the career paths of CSOs, how they often have moved to very disparate industries.
Yeah.
And of course, there's, I'm sure, a huge learning curve.
Yeah. So I'm fortunate in that I'm one of those, well, I guess I'm fortunate in that I'm one of those people who is easily bored. And so I tend to gravitate towards companies and issues that are not easily solved. I'm interested in that work. Me bored is not good.
Sounds like you have a learning quest.
I do.
Yeah,
I do. And then every time I'm going through the learning, which is always incredibly painful, I'm like, why do I want to do this for myself? But it's definitely where I thrive is being dropped into something unfamiliar and trying to figure it out. People are often most curious about my jump from WWF to Walmart because I went from a very large NGO to a huge corporation. And I think for me that was a relatively easy transition because when I was at WWF, I was working with Coca-Cola. So I was sitting across the table from a variety of business executives that were working on hard issues. And the root of that partnership was very much oriented around how does Coca-Cola think about water access, not just for their business, but for the local communities? Because if they lose access to that water, for a variety of reasons, there's a real threat to their license to operate and their business vitality kind of moving forward. But at the end of the day, I was kind of working with business leaders on sustainability issues. And so when I went to Walmart, I was still working on similar issues. I mean, the dynamics were different. At Walmart, I was working on human trafficking in the seafood sector, which is different kind of academically from water availability and access, but the issues and how you kind of approach them, there's some commonality there. The hard part for me going to Walmart was I kind of bought into the, oh, you're going from a nonprofit to this enterprise, and so you probably don't understand kind of the way a business works. And so I really spent some time the first year. I mean, I used to break out in hives when I spoke publicly at Walmart for the first year because I was so like, I'm a fraud. So for me, really feeling confident that I earned that seat at the table and that my voice and my perspective was unique and also helpful and additive was really important, and I had to learn that. So I would say that was the biggest barrier to overcome. And I will say, not to overly simplify the Walmart business model or Coca-Cola, but they're relatively straightforward businesses to get your head around and to understand how they make money, how they market, what do their customers expect. And then I jumped into a utility, and that was, the learning curve was off the charts. I just spent, I think, the first month being like, I think they made a mistake. Like, surely someone else could do this because it's so complicated. The way a regulated utility makes money is kind of upside down from what I was familiar with. The way you think about customers, the way you think about policymakers, it's just fundamentally different. The way you think about technology, how the energy system works, all of that, that varies. And so when I'm going through these at times really incredibly painful learning moments, I do what I think a lot of people do, and I try and cling to what is familiar. And so I spent some time really thinking about, okay, well, Walmart, yes, the business model was retail, but it was a business going through massive transformation. The shift from bricks and mortar to what Walmart calls omnichannel, but basically you can buy anything about 1,000 different ways, to Duke Energy, also going through massive transformation and kind of first generation version of energy to this new, much more dynamic energy system with all kinds of different energy generation sources, and the way the grid kind of functions is just completely new. So really trying to figure out what were some consistent things that would help kind of center me and frame me so that I could say, okay, I may not understand what this person is telling me, but I know what they're dealing with, and I can kind of look into my box of tools and say, okay, but I can pull things forward. I can ask smarter questions. I can think about how other companies, my past experience really helped address a similar issue in a way that, that I think is grounding.
I mean, as much expertise as you have, it seems like you also have a fair bit of humility to know what you don't know. And, and I think that's probably helped you be really successful, as you're willing to listen and ask questions.
Well, I think you're getting at the heart of something that I believe that is fundamental for any successful sustainability practitioner, which is, this is a field that is littered with unintended consequences. And so really, really being thoughtful about, do I actually understand the system that I'm operating in? Do I have a theory of change for how it needs to be improved? Is that theory of change my own, or can I find, you know, others out there that, that might support that theory of change? And there are different theories of change. Some of, and you can have different theories of change and be very legitimate. And then, okay, I, working at Duke or working at Walmart, then what are the actions that I need to be taking in this role at this company that will get to the change that is going to lead to the ultimate transformation? So I think very much a sense of humility is you've got to, as my fellow Darden alum used to say, you got to check yourself before you wreck yourself. So you really do need to do that. And then listening. My other observation, and I've seen this play out time and time again, is you work in sustainability and you're so excited. You just got that big meeting with the business executive or with the company that you're trying to influence or with whomever, and you bring a beautiful PowerPoint deck or whatever your, you know, the Amazon, the one pager or whatever it may be, and you get that meeting and you spend the entire meeting pitching and no time listening. And what I have found is more often than not, just listening to what a stakeholder has to tell me is enables me to make sure that I understand the problem from where they sit. And more often than not, that person, that stakeholder, will tell me what they believe the solution is, which, let's be clear, if I can get someone else to do my homework for me, I am all for it. I don't need to come with the greatest ideas. I just need to figure out who the smart people are in the room and put them together so we can arrive at the greater idea. But more often than not, they'll identify the solution, or if I'm really listening, they'll tell me why they can't do something. And then the problem for me, the task, is to figure out how do I overcome that no and get to a yes.
Wow, I teach negotiations also, and I feel like a lot of this is kind of about thinking integratively yeah. and thinking about what the other person's interests and motivations are to try
Absolutely.
To create value. And just it's one huge long-term negotiation. And
yeah.
actually sounds somewhat similar to maybe what DEIB professionals face as far as understanding,
yeah.
You know, where the challenges are.
Yeah.
We know that ESG job postings have risen in recent years, and that demand for CSOs has grown over 200% in the last decade. According to this research, sustainability teams are increasing in size from 5 to 15. I'm sure not all CSOs feel like they're having the luxury of a team of 15. And younger generations are eager to move into sustainability work or work that has a social mission, even within business. So you've given us some great ideas for how Darden students can think about preparing, but are there any things that you wish you had known, or maybe that you haven't, you know, kind of shared yet about, you know, advice that you would offer people interested in the space?
Yeah, so I don't know if it's stuff that I didn't know. There were so few of us in the beginning, but at the end of the day, this is a very small field, and yes, the teams are growing, and that's certainly welcome. But your reputation, your brand in this space is really fundamental. We spoke about how you need to listen, how you need to be humble about your ideas and your values. But reputations can be lost in a second. And I think over time, having the ability to be that honest broker where I'm coming back to a business partner or I'm approaching a new business partner and people think of me as an honest broker. I'll tell people what I think. I'll bring evidence to support my assertion. But I want to provide a safe space for the conversation that needs to happen about how do we change? How do we evolve forward? How do we identify a risk that maybe previously was not well understood or not believed? And so I really do encourage people to be mindful about how they engage and how they drive that transformation forward, because if you were not seen as an honest broker, if you were seen as steamrolling people, that it tends to be a short-lived career. I think the other thing that may be helpful for folks is, yes, sustainability is all, and ESG is all strategy. It's mitigating risk and it's creating value. But I think it actually ties back to the earlier conversation. Values depend on where you sit. And so my value system and where I would rank order different priorities probably differs from yours. Maybe materially, maybe not materially. It doesn't mean that mine is right and yours are wrong, or yours are right and mine are wrong. It just means that we're guided by perhaps a different moral compass or would prioritize issues differently. And I think that's a really important thing to appreciate, because I think it enables you to sit across from someone in a more constructive, approachable way.
Great. Well, Catherine, thank you so much for joining us today.
A real pleasure.
A pleasure to see you in person and also hear so much insight from you about the space and your career. Thank you so much.
Leadership Unscripted is a Darden speaker series hosted at UVA Darden DC Metro in Arlington, Virginia. To learn more, visit us at darden.virginia.edu.